Should I sit for a moment? Or? I'll sit.
All right.
Okay, welcome to this talk sponsored by Jewish and Israel Studies Certificate Program. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you our speaker today, Professor Derek Penslar. He is the Samuel Zaks Professor of Jewish History and the Director of Jewish Studies Program at the University of Toronto. This semester he's at Harvard, so that's where he's coming from today. His publication list is extremely long between his books and his articles, so I will just highlight a few. He publishes and teaches in modern Jewish history, particularly focusing on Germany and history of the Zionist movement and the State of Israel, and you will see it from the titles. His books include Zionism and Technocracy, The Engineering of Jewish Settlement in Palestine, 1870-1918, Israel in History, The Jewish State in Comparative Perspective, that just came out last year. And he also edited a number of books, co-edited a number of books, In Search of Jewish Community, Jewish Identities in Germany and Austria, 1918-1933, co-edited with Michael Brenner, Shylock's Children, Economic and Jewish Identity in Modern Europe. That's not co-edited, that's your own.
That's mine, yeah.
Yes, I apologize. Israeli Historical Revisionism from Left to Right, co-edited with Anita Shapira. Orientalism and the Jews, edited with Ivan Kalmar. And Contemporary Antisemitism, Canada and the World, co-edited with Michael Maris and Janice Gross-Stein. Professor Penslar is also currently working on a documentary history of Zionism and a book on Jews' involvement in the military and warfare in modern Europe, and modern broadly defined from
1648-1948.
That's right. And he's also co-editor of Jewish Social Studies and Journal of Israeli History. So join me in welcoming Professor Derek Penslar, and he will speak to us today at Israeli History, Myths and Countermyths.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. This is my first visit to Wesleyan, and I am bowled over, frankly, by what I've seen so far and what I've heard about the students as well as the faculty. I also appreciate the chance to talk about a very small country, but one that is perhaps the most controversial one in the world today. And the extent of that controversy was brought home to me just a few days ago when I was at a conference in Washington, D.C., and I was responding to an Israeli journalist named Tom Segev, who's written a number of popular works about the State of Israel. And he's at Berkeley this semester, teaching a course on Israeli representations of Israel in the media. And I asked him what he thought of Berkeley, because that's where I got my doctorate. He said he likes it very much. I asked him what he thought of the students and whether they were politicized, as they were of old. And he said, no, the students at Berkeley only care about two things: organic food and Israel. And you think that through a little bit, and Israel becomes a kind of a code for a whole raft of attitudes, beliefs, policies, and I know that's Berkeley is not the only campus where that can be the case. To go on from there, Israel is the only smaller country of which I know whose history, meaning the actual historical writing about the country, is something for public consumption in journals of public opinion. That is, if you read the New York Review of Books, or the Times Literary Supplement, or the New Republic, or the Nation, or Dissent, or, you know, pick your journal of public opinion, you will find learned books about history of the United States, the former Soviet Union, China, and Israel in great degree. For example, I mentioned Tom Segev, a journalist who is a historical journalist who writes books about Israel. His works are well-read among the intelligentsia in North America. There are very few people in this room, for example, who I'm sure could identify, let's say, a Greek journalist who writes popular stuff about the history of modern Greece, or Danish journalist who writes about the history of modern Denmark, Denmark and Israel being approximately the same size. So what's going on here? What's going on is that Israeli history is the history of a country that is the center of attention to half of humanity. Right from the start, when you add up the number of Christians in the world, the number of Muslims in the world, you have half of humanity right there. And the other half of humanity is not disinterested as well due to the geopolitical significance of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The way that Israeli history is written, however, and the kind of Israeli history that has become widely disseminated in journals of public opinion has changed greatly in the last 20 years. Now, there are many people in this room who are just about 20 years old yourselves, and so around the year you were born, there began a revolution in the way Israelis wrote their history, and at the time it was called the New History. Well, for me to call it new today would be rather silly. It's a deliberate anachronism. It's like calling Oxford's New College new. It was built in 1379. So when I say the New History, I'm talking about sort of like the New Wave in French cinema, right? It is a term of art, and it's a historical category in and of itself. What the New History proclaimed in the 1980s when it developed, in the 1990s when it really peaked, and then it kind of went into a trough after that, was really that Israel should be studied by the same sorts of tools and conceptual categories that historians had long been using since the 1960s, if not earlier, for studying various countries, historians of the United States, studying their own country, historians of France, Germany, Italy, you name it. That is, the tools of critical historiography in which the purpose of the historian is not to be the handmaid of the nation, but rather to be its critic. What I've called elsewhere, in an article that I published some time ago and I won't rehash, what I called the creation of the adversarial or anti-Whiggish approach to the writing of history is something that has developed in North America in the 1960s, adumbrated already in the 1920s. For those of you who are American historians, I do not deny the importance of Charles Beard. I'm just focusing on the 1960s adversarial moment. Israeli scholars who began to get PhDs in the United Kingdom and in the United States began to absorb this way of thinking about their country's past. Also, young countries take time before they get to a point where the population of the country feels sufficiently nativized, comfortable in its own skin. The country is no longer a statement, but is simply a fact of being. That they can begin to view their history in a more critical way. For example, it's interesting that the new history in Israel begins to develop about four decades after the state is founded. You see a very similar thing in Ireland, which is founded in the early 1920s, and it takes, in that case, about five decades before the revisionist controversies in Irish historiography began, with historians beginning to say previously heretical things like, well, maybe the English weren't so bad after all. You know, that is, they began to question the founding myths of their own past. And Israeli historians began to do the same thing. What happened is, and here I'll introduce some concepts that will run through the talk, rather than speak in nationalist myths, essentialist myths about the inextricable connection, let's say, between the Jewish past and the state of Israel, notions of Israel's historic complete innocence of any wrongdoing and its dealings with the Arab states and so forth, historians began to craft a different sort of narrative. Myths always sustained by a narrative, which I'll call a counter-narrative, which provided a more critical and more nuanced approach to Israel's past. For example, just the most classic example being that in 1948, the young state of Israel was militarily more prepared than historians had previously acknowledged, that the Arab states were less prepared, that the Arab states were not unified in their war aims against Israel. In other words, that the 1948 war, which is the seminal war which Israel was created, was not so much a battle of a David versus a Goliath, so much as a battle between poorly armed, poorly coordinated forces, and as it turns out, Israel had the better hand. That's an example of counter-narrative. Another example of counter-narrative from the late 1980s had to do with the origins of the Palestinian refugee problem. The Zionist myth being that Palestinians left voluntarily, and happily, in the belief that the Zionists would be destroyed and they would come back and share the spoils. Israeli historians came along in the late 80s and said this is nonsense. Palestinians fled out of fear for their lives, and on many occasions they were expelled from their homes. But it was a complicated story with all sorts of nuance. This is what I mean by, again, counter-narrative. And the counter-narrative has been extremely helpful, because although it was viciously attacked by, I'd say, Israeli historians of a younger generation, older generation, when it first came out, in time, lots of it has been accepted. So if you read books now written in the aughts about Israel, they will accept a great deal of this counter-narrative, their approach towards Israel's history, more nuanced, more critical, perhaps a bit more jaded than it would have been 20, 30, 40 years ago. But there is a difference between the kind of counter-narrative I've discussed so far, which I think is quite helpful and, in fact, necessary. Without it, historical progress, historiographical progress can't take place at all, and something else, which is the creation of counter-myth. That is, in counter, hold on, I'm about to trip here on all these various wires that you've set up for me. In counter-myth, as opposed to counter-narrative, the category victim and oppressor is not deconstructed, it's merely reversed. In counter-myth, as opposed to counter-narrative, intentions determine actions. In counter-myth, as opposed to counter-narrative, the sort of secrecy or opacity which is necessary for statecraft is automatically defined as collusion and conspiracy, right? And so what happens in counter-myth is that, so for example, for Israeli scholars of a certain type, Israel no longer is simply now seen as a party that plays some role in the creation of the Arab-Israeli conflict that has agency, but rather Israel becomes identified as the villain, pure and simple. And of course, there's always been this kind of approach towards Israel's history, not coming from Israeli scholars so much as coming from scholars in the Middle Eastern world, journalists in the Middle Eastern world, and a certain strain in the European and North American hard left, which historically viewed Israel as a racist imperialist state, very much a poodle of the United States, and a classic, sort of the classic argument one can find in the work of, I assume Norman Finkelstein's been brought to the Wesleyan campus, a very common figure on college campuses. And I would say that's kind of a classic, long-standing sort of counter-mythological view of Israel. Much more intelligent version would be the work of Noam Chomsky. And among serious historians, the historian Ilan Pape, who some of you should read if you're seriously interested in Israel, a man with very, very powerful political views, very much convinced of the righteousness of his beliefs, and where counter-narrative really becomes counter-myth, and documents are cited quite selectively in order to prove his political point of view. Now, I'm not entirely against counter-myth, because the kind of anger that can propel a scholar into creating a counter-mythological work can create a book which is then of great use and value. It'll be passionate, it'll be interesting to read, and then scholars can go and read it and look at the notes and then try to figure out what's true and what's not. But to offer a conceptual distinction between two very different kinds of myths then, what one might call a kind of pro-Zionist myth that was created by Zionist scholars of earlier generations, and a counter-myth, what lies underneath them is not that one is right and one is wrong, because myth is myth. Myth always contains elements of truth in it. Counter-myth always contains elements of truth in it. But to use a literary analogy, to talk about different points of a departure and arrival that I would argue have a sort of literary typological quality. What do I mean by that? If you look at the kind of basic Zionist mythological narrative and then the basic Palestinian mythological narrative, they're almost two different literary genres. The Palestinian one is a tragedy, and the Israeli one is a romance, with a capital R. A tragedy, a story of, for the Palestinians, unrelenting victimhood. Colonialism in the late 19th century, Zionist encroachment in the early 20th century, British duplicity, American duplicity, Arab duplicity and mendacity, and then finally 1948, al-Nakba, the great catastrophe, the Palestinians lose their homes, and then more duplicity, more betrayal, and a revolutionary struggle which as of yet has yielded little but misery. That's the sort of Palestinian tragic narrative. The Zionist narrative is a romance, which is a bit different, with a capital R. It begins in tragedy, or victimhood, right, oppression, in late 19th century, and then it veers off into this kind of very characteristically Zionist typological mixture of hubris and panic. That is, on the one hand, there's the disaster element, which is everything leading up to the Holocaust, the destruction of European Jewry, the creation of the Jewish state and the wars that follow, but also a sense of hubris, the power of the state, the power of the state to prevail over Arabs time and time again in warfare. We're talking about two very different genres. And when you read a book, and I know there's a lot of undergraduates here, and I'm actually speaking to you directly, when you read a book about the Arab-Israeli conflict or about Palestinians or about Israel, ask yourself which side of the divide, as it were, the book falls down upon. That is, no matter how nuanced or critical an Israeli scholar might be, if they come from a kind of fundamental Zionist narrative, they fall on one side of the divide. And let's say the same thing could be said for someone on the Palestinian side. So, for example, I think of Rashid Khalidi. Some of you have read his work. A wonderful scholar of Palestinian history. Nuanced, critical, deep, outstanding. But in the end, he falls on one side of the divide. And I wouldn't compare myself in terms of stature to Rashid Khalidi, but I'd say my own work, critical, quite critical, of all sorts of aspects of Zionism, but a certain fundamental sympathy, which puts my work on the other side of the divide. And for years I resisted this. I said, oh no, I don't fall on one side of the divide or the other. And then finally students convinced me that in fact I am, and that's okay. I mean, we all write from our subject position and I have to accept that. So what I want to do in the time that I have is illustrate these themes of myth, counter-myth, narrative, counter-narrative by talking about a very controversial subject and a quite concrete one, perhaps the single most controversial subject in the history of Zionism and the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is the origin of the idea of what's called euphemistically in Hebrew transfer, that is the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland. This is an idea that has tremendous ideological traction for critics and enemies of Zionism in the state of Israel, and has aroused very strong defensive reactions in people who are supportive of the state of Israel. And I'm going to do it in a couple of different parts. I'm going to talk about the origins of this notion that Zionists plotted from the very beginning to expropriate the Palestinian population. Then I'll talk about the alleged culmination of this idea in the 1940s, and then I'll finish with some general discussions about engagement and neutrality in historiographical writing. So let me start with the founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl. And if you read classic works written by Israeli scholars who are quite defensive about Herzl, quite apologetic for him, they present Herzl as a great lover of the Arabs. What's their evidence for this? Well, Herzl wrote a utopian novel in 1902 called Old New Land, Al Neuland, or in Hebrew, Tel Aviv, which features an Arab character, Rashid Bey, who speaks flawless German with a North German accent because he went to the Technische Hochschule of Hanover. And he speaks with great gratitude about all the benefits that Zionists have brought the Arab people and how wonderful it is that the Zionists have come and that there's plenty of room in the country for everyone and so on. They also point out that Herzl did make other references to Arabs in general in his diaries, often quite positive references, but by and large they rely on the Alt-Neuland idyll. Scholars who are critical of Israel have a different take, which is, well, you know, Alt-Neuland is a novel full of characters, one Arab, obviously it's tokenism. We never see an Arab village. We never see Rashid Bey's wife, who he talks about quite a bit. And there is an interfaith religious service towards the end of the book, and there's no Muslims and no Arabs. We have a Roman Catholic, we have Greek Catholic, we have Orthodox, because clearly Herzl is a Habsburg intellectual who's thinking about creating in Palestine a Habsburg Empire, Zuta, a small version of the Habsburg Empire. It's multi-confessional, but it's not binational. It's not in his head. And there was a scholar named Mohammed Khalidi who wrote an article about this who pointed this out, and he's right, that's a very effective critique. But then he goes too far. Then he writes, clearly, in Herzl's Alt-Neuland, all the Palestinians have been expelled. Where does he get this from? So you see what I mean about the difference between a kind of an effective criticism to then going to make a kind of wild political statement. Scholars who are critical of Herzl point out, I think, very helpfully, that Herzl in fact had very little to say about Palestinian Arabs in his own Zionist career. He paid very little attention to them. When he went to Palestine in 1898, he basically ignored them, which is telling. But perhaps the most damning piece of evidence regarding Herzl's view towards the Palestinian Arabs, at least according to those who are hostile to Zionism, comes from Herzl's own diary. Because on June 12, 1895, Herzl wrote the following in his diary, and I quote, "We must expropriate gently the private property on the estates assigned to us. We shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit countries while denying it employment in our own country. The property owners will come over to our side. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly. The property owners may believe they're cheating us, selling to us more than the land is worth, but nothing will be sold back to them." This is Herzl's own diary. Now, if you look at any standard biography of Herzl written by a Zionist Israeli author, the diary quote is simply not mentioned. It's just ignored. People who come from the right wing sometimes refer to it to justify their own desire to get rid of Palestine's Arabs. To put it very Canadianly, that is euphemistically, I've been living in Canada for 10 years where we're never allowed to say anything directly. So to put it mildly, scholars who are critical of Zionism view this rather differently. And if you go to Google and type in Herzl diary, June 12, 1895, you'll find 10 or 20,000 hits from anti-Zionist websites of various kinds or another that quote from this diary entry to quote prove, end quote, that Herzl and by definition all Zionists and the Zionist movement intended from the very beginning to expel the Palestinian population from the country. And this point of view has been cited over and over again on the web. Edward Said cited it as proof of the Zionist desire to get rid of the native population, and so on. And it's true that when we look inside Herzl's diaries, we find all kinds of very strange stuff. I don't know how many people here have actually read through them, but for undergraduates who are looking for research essay topics, there's nothing more fascinating than really going through Theodor Herzl's diaries, which have been translated in their entirety. The translation's old, it's not perfect, there's a newer German version, but, you know, it's okay. They're full of weird things. Herzl writes that the Jewish state should have a vast army, and he was actually thinking for a while of putting the Jewish state in Latin America. He didn't decide on Palestine really until 1896. And he thought it should have a vast army that could defeat all the Latin American states put together. He also had visions of hiring the native population to kill wild animals, and as he put it, big snakes. He was convinced whatever state would be Jewish would be full of big snakes, which I suppose has some Freudian meaning. He admired Cecil Rhodes, the father of British colonialism in South Africa. I mean, there is a lot of colonial fantasy in Herzl's diaries. He writes that the Jewish state will feature secret administrative police, that the press will be censored, disagreement with the state will be punishable by banishment or even death. Herzl writes that all of the directives that he's writing in his diary are secret. They'll be transmitted secretly to the future leaders of the Jewish state, but never intended for public consumption, and so on and so forth. This is all in his diaries. They're really interesting. There's an assumption, though, that critics of Herzl make, that the diary entries were coherent, lucid, and programmatic, and that they're far more important than the later things that Herzl actually said in public or wrote for public consumption. And it's based on, I think, what I would call the historiographical fallacy, which is that an unpublished source is always to be accorded primacy in indicating an author's state of mind or intent, that mediation always implies adulteration or concealment. I'm not so sure. What I would like to do is offer my own vision of Herzl's diary entries and what they mean, a counter-narrative vision, which does not try to apologize for Herzl's obvious wackiness. June 12, 1895. What's going on in Herzl's life? Theodor Herzl has been in the grip of what is literally, clinically, a manic fit. It's a manic fit that lasted a period of some 3 weeks. He was himself clinically bipolar. He went through a manic phase. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages. He would go on walks in the garden, jot down things on pieces of paper, and then throw the papers into his room, and then later on assemble some of it, and leave other stuff out. Some of these random jottings wound up becoming the pamphlet, The Jewish State. During this storm of inspiration, Herzl actually thought he was going out of his mind. He wrote about all kinds of things. He wrote that the Jewish temple would be rebuilt. He wrote that the high priest would wear silver breastplates. He wrote that suicides would be publicly shamed. He wrote that there would be dueling in the Jewish state to maintain honor. He wrote about all kinds of things. And in the midst of this burst of logorrhea, I guess logorrhea by definition is a burst, he wrote on June 12th 40 pages in print, beginning with a fantasy that he would like to fight a duel with Karl Lueger, the anti-Semitic mayor of Vienna, and Georg von Schönauer, the anti-Semitic Austrian parliamentarian. He figured if he were killed, he would die a martyr, and if he killed them, he would plead his case before the court with great drama, because he was a dramatist, not a very good one, but he was a dramatist, and that he would win the sympathy of the court and thereby win the sympathy of the Habsburg Empire. In the middle of all of this, we have the one paragraph I've cited to you about the expropriation of the natives. He then jumps on to other things. He writes about real estate purchase. He obviously gets bored and then moves on to writing about the Jewish state's flag and other items of that sort. Clearly, this is revealing. Herzl was an interesting man, a troubled man, but to claim that this one paragraph in the midst of this sea of unbalanced writing somehow predicts the actions of the entire Zionist movement half a century down the line is, I think, going much too far. Do feverish thoughts confided to a private diary express innermost yearnings? Do they augur future actions? My own sense is Herzl changed fundamentally after 1895. He became a Zionist leader. He founded the World Zionist Organization. He began negotiating with European diplomatic heads of state. Basically, to put it in Yiddish, he mensched up. I think he had to grow up. Did he grow up entirely? Did he fundamentally overcome his basic personality? No, because nobody ever does. But I think he did change. And we have evidence from 1899, 1901, 1903, where Herzl deals with Arab issues in a much more nuanced and subtle way. And look at the way Herzl ran the Zionist organization. He ran it democratically, not oligarchically. Saber duels were not fought in the halls of the Basel Casino. Most of the wacky stuff that he wrote in his diary was never implemented, nor did he make any effort to implement it. And I want to bring up here a final piece of evidence before I finish up with Herzl. And this is sort of like not the smoking gun, but a very important piece of evidence, much less well-known than the diary entry. For this, you have to go to an archive. In the Central Zionist Archives in Jerusalem, there is a draft charter that Herzl wrote up in 1901 for a colonization company which he hoped the Ottoman Empire would allow to colonize Jews in Palestine. It's a legal document, very bureaucratically written. It contains a paragraph which claims, and I won't read the whole paragraph here, it claims that this colonization company would have the right to selectively expropriate property of individuals in exchange for compensation and so forth, kind of eminent domain. It does account for the possibility that natives would be moved from their lands. And clearly Herzl was interested in this because David Wolfson, who took over after Herzl died as president of the WZO, Wolfson made his own copy in his own handwriting of this draft, both in German and in French, and that paragraph is missing from both of Wolfson's handwritten versions. So clearly Herzl had in mind, you know, natives might be moved, but it is much more subtle, much more limited than the kind of crazy ideas that we had previously. I think that the charter reflects audacity, but also a certain political maturity. Now, is my reading correct? I don't know. That'll be you to judge. It is sympathetic. And here I want to make an important distinction between sympathy and empathy. I think that all historians have an obligation to be sympathetic to their subjects. They have to understand where their subjects are coming from. But they don't need to be empathetic, which is to actually share the points of view that their subjects did express. I mean, Herzl was in many ways a rather unpleasant figure. He was a cruel husband and an absent father. He was an exquisite neurotic. I've described him as a narcissist suffering from unrequited love. So he was rather a messed up figure. But to generalize from one paragraph to the entire history of Zionism strikes me as going much too far. Now, critics of Zionism claim that Herzl represents only the beginning, and that throughout the 1920s, but particularly the later 1930s and the 1940s, the Zionist leadership in Palestine systematically planned to expel the Palestinian population. The claim is that already in 1937, at the time of the Peel Commission, which proposed partitioning Palestine into Jewish and Arab states, the Jewish state would have a very large Arab minority, actually almost equal to the Jewish state's Jewish population, that Zionist leaders began calling for the British to implement forced expulsion, transfer was the euphemistic term, of Palestinians from their native homes. And then the argument goes that this became an ever more concrete policy in World War II, 1946-47. The latest version of this, I just read in a book on the way up, actually I'm not at Harvard this term, I'm back in Toronto, but on the way down I read a new book by Ilan Pape called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine in 1948, which claims that already in April of 1942, when Zionists gathered in New York at the Hotel Biltmore, Biltmore Hotel, demanded a Jewish state in all of Palestine, they were both implicitly and in secret explicitly demanding that Arabs be expelled from the state, or what would become the state. So the argument goes, planned expulsion, 1946-47, the argument goes, David Ben-Gurion puts together a team of experts, military experts, and intelligence officials who will implement it, and then in November of 1947, the argument goes, the implementation begins, Arab villages are raided, Arabs are driven from their home, and then this is given a kind of post facto coherence in April of 1948 with the formation of what was called Plan D, Tochnit Dalet, a plan by which the Jewish military in the Jewish state of Borning would expel Palestinians from all territories in what was to be the Jewish state. This is a very clean, coherent argument, right? Planned expulsion, realized already before April of 1948, but then confirmed and clarified by Plan D. Now, for those of you who work on the Holocaust, this argument will sound very familiar. The Wannsee Conference, as we all know, the Wannsee Protocol of January 1942, does not predict what will happen. It actually confirms what is already happening, right? And so I've got a funny feeling that Ilan Pape had this in mind when he wrote his latest book. Okay, is this true? I'm very suspicious of the argument because to the extent that I have looked at the documentation they cite, whenever it's a document that I know, and I don't work myself, I don't specialize in the 1940s, and people who work on this subject are very narrowly specialists, like Benny Morris, who wrote the most important book on the origins of the Palestine refugee problem, 350-page book, has now reissued it, 750 pages. The Palestine Refugee Problem Revisited, and now he's written a new book, 1,000 pages, The History of the 1948 War. In a world of hedgehogs and foxes, Benny Morris is a hedgehog. And I'm a hedgehog, I guess, I'm just disguising myself as a fox. The problem is that whenever I see a document that I do know, it doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense. I'll just give an example. Ilan Pape says, of course the Zionists intended, even in the 30s, to expel the Arab population, because Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, who was the chair of the Jewish Agency Executive and the head of the dominant political party in Jewish Palestine, the Yishuv, wrote a letter to his son Amos in October of 1937 saying, quote, we will expel the Arabs. And I thought, well, I know that letter. I actually have the letter in its entirety. It's a four-page, single-spaced letter. It's about all kinds of things. And in it, Ben-Gurion is trying to convince his son, who is to the right of him politically, not to the right, I shouldn't say that, his son has a more aggressive militaristic stand than Ben-Gurion does, and his son opposes partition. And Ben-Gurion is in favor of partition, and he writes, the full quote is something like, partition will not endanger our deterrent capacity. We will expel the Arabs from Palestine. We'll expel them from Transjordan. We'll do whatever we need to do in order to assure, and I think, we'll expel them from Transjordan? Ben-Gurion didn't mean that. Nobody talked about that. And Ben-Gurion never seriously thought about expelling Arabs from Transjordan. It never shows up in any document, in any policy statement. Even Ilan Pape would never say that Ben-Gurion wanted to expel the Arabs from Transjordan. What's going on here, if you read the letter as a whole, he is trying to say, don't worry. If we have a small Jewish state in a sliver of Palestine, we will have the power to do what we need to do. Okay? He's not saying we will definitely expel the Arabs from everywhere that we possibly can. And I've been thinking about this as I look at more documents from the period, which are often nuanced. You'll have one person who says we should expel the Arabs, and somebody else will say we shouldn't. Ben-Gurion one day will say, well, transfer would be nice if it could be accomplished, but it can't be because world opinion won't allow it. And I'm thinking to myself, perhaps the anti-Zionist critique is saying that the Zionists planned to expel the Palestinians from the very beginning because they should have, from a rational point of view. That is, it makes sense from the perspective of 1949. Of course the Zionists should have planned to expel the Palestinians. I mean, if they wanted to create a Jewish state, and if they wanted it to have viable borders, and if they wanted to have room for Jews to immigrate from all over the world, it makes sense from a rational point of view. And the Zionists are portrayed in anti-Zionist literature as being quintessentially rational, Western, colonial, scientific, technologically savvy. They should have planned it. But I don't think that that approach quite accurately accounts for how irrational and erratic Zionist political thinking could be. On one level, Zionist political thinking was deeply rational and based on a faith in time. In the 1920s through the mid-30s, most Zionists believed that anti-Jewish feeling, anti-Zionist feeling on the part of Palestine's Arabs would fade, that eventually things would work out, that there would be massive Jewish immigration. There was a kind of irrational faith in time. That began to fade in the mid-1930s. It began to fade, but even though it did, I'm actually not surprised at how much discussion there is about transfer. I'm surprised at how little there is. There's some discussions within the Jewish Agency for Palestine, but for the most part, the assumption is that one will just sort of plug along, carry on, and hope for the best. Just to cite an example, Chaim Elazaroff, who was a brilliant Zionist political leader who was gunned down, he was killed very young, in 1933. Elazaroff, the year before he dies, writes Chaim Weizmann, who was the WZO president, a memorandum saying the situation in Palestine is terrible. Arabs oppose us, the British oppose us, we have four choices. The status quo, which is probably not going to get us what we want, give up altogether and go back to Europe, which is a tragedy. Partition, Arlazarov talks about partition already in 1932, which he believes will not give the Jews what they need territorially. And then he says, well, perhaps we should launch a dictatorial revolution, like basically a Bolshevik revolution in Palestine, and that we will then overthrow the British through armed force. He sends this letter to Chaim Weizmann. He never gets a response. The issue is never raised again. Right? I mean, Arlazarov is killed a year later. It's interesting to know what would have happened if he'd stayed, if he hadn't been killed. But my own sense is that these expressions of desperation were not followed through, and that for the most part, the sense was a kind of a, and I use this term very carefully, a kind of messianic hopefulness, that although the Zionist leaders were themselves secular, there was this sense that everything will be solved bimlo azman, that the Zionist problem will be solved in the future. You see this in the way that the Zionist leaders' actions were not planned. I mean, the Palmach, which is the Haganah, the Jewish militia in Palestine, the Palmach's permanently mobilized force, was not created by the Jews themselves. If you look at classic Zionist historiography, they say it was. It wasn't. It was the British who encouraged its creation in order to get proxy forces to fight in Vichy-controlled Syria and North Africa. The Haganah, the Jewish mainstream militia in the 1940s, was riven with all kinds of internal discord, and Ben-Gurion had limited control over it because the Haganah General Command mainly consisted of people from a rival political party. There was a constant threat in the late 1940s, we're talking about even during the 1948 war itself, of civil war between Jews in Palestine, between the revisionists associated with Menachem Begin and his militia, the Irgun, and the mainstream, if you want to call it that, forces of the Haganah. And this was brought home to me in something I found literally in a shoe, like in a, something that was supposed to be lost, but in the Haganah archive in Tel Aviv, I found public opinion surveys from the 1948 war. were allegedly lost, but evidently they were buried in a box with a bunch of other stuff. And there's a public opinion survey carried out by the Haganah's, what was it called, the Agaf Lechekag Dat Akal, so the branch for, or the department for, a bureau for the investigation of public opinion. And they ask, this is during the 1948 war itself, this is April, May, June 1948. And people express fear for their lives, they're afraid they're going to, you know, the Arabs are going to attack them, or once the Arabs attack, that they're going to defeat them. There's also real fear of civil war between labor-oriented and revisionist-oriented Jews. And this is right during the time of the Altalena affair in June of 1948, when a revisionist arms ship docks off the coast of Palestine, anchors off the coast of Palestine, and Ben-Gurion orders it sunk. So there's a lot of fear in Palestine at the time among Jews of civil war. There was a great deal of disorder in Palestine on both the senior leadership level and the popular level in late 1947 through mid-1948. Now, the Israelis won the war, right? And it does not mean, when I say that things were disordered, that does not mean that atrocities weren't carried out, because they were. Israeli forces did expel people from Arab villages at gunpoint. And they did, not only at Deir Yassin, which is the most famous case outside of Jerusalem, but in other cases, they did gun down unarmed people, right? These things did happen. 100,000 Palestinians were forced from their homes in the Lydda-Ramla area and forced over the border into Jordan with the direct approval of David Ben-Gurion and his commander on the scene, the young Yitzhak Rabin. And these things did happen, okay? I'm not denying that. What I'm questioning is the notion of lockstep conspiratorial planning. Anyone's lived in Israel for any length of time, we know that Israel is, one of these days when I write my textbook history of Israel, I'm going to call it the improvised society, in Hebrew, the Chevra Me'ulteret, which is a society which does borrow from certain Western scientific, colonial, cultural norms, but also does a great many things on the fly. I think this argument is very hard for people who are hostile to Zionism to accept, because when you're victimized, you want to believe that your victim had a coherent plan. And you want to believe in the sort of evil genius theory of the oppressor. I think what we have instead is a kind of a dynamic. You could call it inevitable if you want, but given the aspirations of Palestinians, the aspirations of Jews, the fact that Jews in Palestine did have superior fighting techniques, they did have superior access to weaponry, and particularly to ammunition. And here's just a little what they call in Hebrew a curiosa, a little tidbit that you'll find very interesting. One reason why the Israelis win the 1948 war is not because they have massively superior weaponry. It's not because they have a massively superior air force. The air force on both sides was lousy. They had more bullets. And why did they have more bullets? Well, they were able to manufacture bullets in basement factories, and they were able to smuggle more small arms into Palestine because of international connections with Jews in Australia, the United States, and other places. This is a very small thing, right? So small things put together help account for historical victories. So the attempts I've been making to present historical truth as messy, untidy, and not fitting into neat mythological or counter-mythological frameworks might strike some of you as overly diffident, like the view of the late Israeli Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, who when asked if he wanted coffee or tea would allegedly say both. There is something that particularly when you're dealing with a historically controversial subject, certain people are going to find very maddening about an on the one hand, on the other hand approach. But I don't think I'm offering a relativist approach. In fact, quite the opposite. And let me illustrate my argument with a reference to someone who I can't believe I'll ever quote approvingly, but that's Leo Strauss. Leo Strauss, in his commentaries and Al-Arabi's commentaries on Plato, writes that taking an intermediate position between two philosophical extremes is not an act of compromise. But rather, he writes, it suppresses them both, uproots them by a prior, more profound question, whose result is a truly critical philosophy. And so what I'm arguing is that the blending of opposing ideologically driven approaches to Zionism can produce not merely a compound, but actually a new element, a truly critical historiography, which does not waver from the search for historical truth. And indeed, I do believe in the search for historical truth, which perhaps, although not ultimately attainable, is highly approximable, akin to the limit of a mathematical function as x approaches infinity. or to move away back from the realm of math, because I've now exhausted my mathematical knowledge, back to history. It is simply illogical, in the case of the Arab-Israeli conflict, fundamentally illogical to attribute responsibility primarily to one side or the other, because of the fact that the power differential, although there was a power differential in 1948, which ultimately came down on the side of the Israelis, there's at least enough equity on the part of the power relationship between the two that we can speak of a national struggle whose end is not predetermined in advance. I raise this because of the common claim in counter-mythological writing on Israel that the Israelis were overwhelmingly powerful and the Arabs overwhelmingly weak. This is simply not true. It's a problem, I think, in the literature on ethnic conflict in general, whether it's Kosovo and the Serbs versus the Albanians, or whether it's Darfur. These are cases where often, although there was clearly one aggressor, guilty aggressor, the victim is often not entirely bereft of agency or responsibility. And that might be a politically incorrect statement, but it's actually true for most ethnic conflicts. In the case of Palestine and the Israelis, Palestinians made choices, Palestinians had certain opportunities. The Israelis did as well. The Israelis ultimately did prevail. This is why, despite some of my critics, and I'm in an ongoing debate with many of my critics, I'd say, in the anti-Zionist camp, who refuse to call the 1948 war a national or ethnic conflict. They call it a colonial war, a war of colonial extermination. I find that unhelpful, because it was very much a war in which the Israelis were, it was a very small scale, small arms guerrilla war. There's a whole book on this by David Tall about the 1948 war is really a dirty war, a small war. The Israelis were superior, but not necessarily foreordained in 1946 or 47. That's why I don't call what happened in 1948 a genocide. For a genocide to occur, you have to have an absolutely massive power inequity between oppressor and victim. There's the Armenian genocide. There's the genocide of the Nazi Holocaust and so on. 1948 is not a genocide. I am becoming more sympathetic, even though it's a controversial term, to calling what happened in 1948 ethnic cleansing, because you have, perhaps in the fog of war, but then increasingly legitimized by state power, you do have concerted attempts to uproot a population from its native land, drive it out, and then prevent its return. And that's very clear, that the Israelis do everything possible to prevent the return of Palestinians to their homes. This was brought home to me, again, when I was looking at the archives. Haganah Radio in Haifa in 1948 broadcasts that Arabs who have left their homes in Haifa should understand that once the Arabs make peace with Israel, they'll be allowed to return. Moshe Sharet, the foreign minister of Israel, writes an angry letter to Kol Yisrael, which is the Haganah radio station, which will become the official Israeli radio station, an angry letter saying, don't you dare say that sort of thing. It's not true. It's not going to happen. Right? So, you know, I think we can make an argument for ethnic cleansing. The problem, though, is that like the use of the term apartheid to describe Israeli policies in the West Bank today, the term is so loaded, right, that when people use the term ethnic cleansing, it is often associated then with the argument that Israel shouldn't exist, right? And that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying when I taught this at Harvard last year and I said, is what Israel did ethnic cleansing? The students said, well, what's ethnic cleansing? And we defined it and then we came up with, you know, whether or not what Israel did fit. I'm just simply trying to come up with a historical explanatory framework for it. Clearly then, if we're going to talk about things like ethnic cleansing, we're always going to be politically engaged. I mentioned that at the beginning of my talk, and here I'm going to finish. Anybody who decides to go into academia working on the Middle East, Middle Eastern history, encourages no small amount of professional or even personal risk by doing it. We don't do it for the money. We do it because we care. And yet there is a difference between engaged scholarship, even that which might have a mythological agenda, and pure polemics. And I think that what I would, again, encourage those of you who are students to look for when you pick up books on the Arab-Israeli conflict, look for a book whose conclusions you cannot predict before you even get to page one. And you will find remarkably few books that pass that test, right? And that's probably not a good sign. There are so many interesting questions regarding Israel's origins and development, causation and consequence, intention and happenstance, consensus and contestation. contestation. And yet, there is a temperamental divide between the true scholar and the polemicist, in that the scholar, well, the polemicist is allergic to nuance, and the scholar is incapable of brevity, which is why I want to finish now. Scholars will strive, but will not succeed, falling into the pitfalls of myth and counter-myth. But they must at least adhere to the norms of scholarship, the old-fashioned positivist norms, footnotes, extensive documentation, letting people go and find the sources you used yourself, being willing to admit error, which for me has been the hardest thing, because I've been working on Israeli history now for 25 years. My own views about Israel's history and my own approaches to Israel changed greatly over the last 25 years, because it is subject to change. We have to understand that scholars will have different narratives, not even if they are polemicists, not even if they are immersed in myth or counter-myth, but simply because, and this is where I started, we have different points of departure and arrival. My point of departure is different from that. I'm thinking, I mentioned Rashid Khalidi because I admire him greatly. His point of departure is different from mine. And I almost feel that with him and he, our points of arrival are very close, but they're not quite the same. Almost, and yet still somewhat separate. And yet, I think that the competing narratives, and if I here I'll finish with an allusion to a Cartesian grid, the competing narratives do not exist only in separate quadrants with no points of intersection. The narratives are more like waves of varying amplitudes, but coursing through multiple quadrants. They intersect and diverge and conjoin yet again. And as in the past, so in the present and the future, the points of convergence provide a moment of authentic encounter, a possibility of agreement, and the beginning of a new narrative. Thank you very much. So I welcome your comments and questions and narratives. Yes, sir. Sure. Well, this is the big question about what is it about the past in the writing of history which is true in the sense that this chair exists, as opposed to a narrative structure. And the problem is the word history, as Hegel himself pointed out, means both that which happened and the tale of that which happened. So how do we separate the two? I think there's remarkable agreement among scholars, and here the Arab-Israeli conflict merely becomes an exemplum of a much broader issue. We can agree about things that happened. The King David Hotel blew up. Right? The King David Hotel blew up in 1946, okay. And we even can agree on who blew it up. It was the Irgun, the revisionist militia. We can agree on that. So it's actually amazing when you do historical comparison, you read books written from many different political points of view, we can agree the hotel blew up, we can agree who planted the bomb, we can agree on the time of day, and then we're going to get to the points of disagreement. Responsibility, factual disagreement. Did the Irgun phone in a warning? Did they not phone in a warning? And then interpretive disagreement. Was this event unique? Was it sui generis? Was it part of a general plan? Did the Haganah know about it? Did the Haganah approve of it? And then you get into the realm of what is debatable. What I'm arguing is, and it also gets back to the question of causation, because back when I was in graduate school, I'm a product of the era of late Marxism, when we believed in causation, and we believed that things could be explained. Now, you're all a product, I guess, of the post-postmodern era, in which there is no causation, only genealogy. You've all been taught that. There is no causation, only genealogy. I get this at U of T all the time, because my students have been weaned on Foucault and Derrida, and I have to sort of work really hard. No, things happen, you know. And there's a but even my son, who's 21, so I use him as my sort of touchstone, says, oh, no, Dad, there's only genealogies, because all we have are chains of events. We can't prove causation, blah, blah, blah. Fine. I'm arguing, again, causation cannot be proven, but it can be approximated to such a nth degree close to certainty that for all extents and purposes, it is proven. For example, as some of you might know, this is not solid, right? This is merely a molecular field. So is my hand. Theoretically, I could put my hand through this table. It's not very likely, right, given the nature of solid matter and so forth. Okay. That's my own view towards history. We have to separate that which is approximately knowable to a degree of what I would call functional certainty from that which we have to then debate about, right? And it's very, so the Arab-Israeli conflict is merely a neat case. You could apply it to, you know, many, many other historical circumstances. Yes? I'll tell you his book that you should read because it's really good. Anyway,
all right,
yes, what's your question?
And you spoke about how your partner in the Bible was close, but it wasn't. And I was wondering if by having different starting points, you are connecting to the place with the different people, and whether or not scholars have, you know, most tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what is that? Is it in Amos? Can two walk together except they have agreed? Can two walk together except they have agreed? I think is the Revised Standard Translation of it. I don't know. I was throwing that out as a point. I don't know if it's true. I suspect it is, because I was just thinking when Rashid Khalidi, who holds the Edward Said Chair of Middle Eastern History at Columbia, was on, what's this show on American television where people talk about their books? It's on public television. Pardon? Well, then they should move to Canada and do it there. That's what all the CBC does. It's either that or documentaries about nickel mining in Sudbury. So, you know, I'd rather. Rashid Khalidi wrote a book called The Iron Cage, which is a kind of a popular history of the Palestinians, Palestinian National Movement. It's a good book. But I'd never seen him. And there was this guy on TV talking about Israel and the Palestinians and stuff, and I thought, yeah, this guy's making a lot of sense, you know, I mean, you know, maybe that far apart. Who is this guy? And I thought it was Rashid Khalidi, whose stuff I'd read. I'll give you a concrete example of how the points of departure probably do lead almost always to differing points of arrival. This is a project that also might interest many of the students in this class, the PRIME project, funded by the Ford Foundation, to create Israeli and Palestinian competing narratives of history. Have you read about this? This is really, a friend of mine is the head of the Israeli team, which is why I know about it. There's a bunch of Israeli school teachers and Palestinian school teachers who have been getting together for years now in East Jerusalem and trying to write a common narrative of the history of their peoples. Well, they realized after a while they can't do that because they disagree about everything. So they agreed to write a narrative for each people that will at least be minimally acceptable to the other. And it's called the Two Narrative Project. And it has been created now in three workbooks. The third workbook is just being completed now, and it's being used on a very, very small scale and illicitly in the Palestinian territories and in the State of Israel. The previous Israeli education minister forbade its use. There's a new Israeli education minister who has different views. She hasn't forbade it. I don't think she's expressly permitted it either, but it's being used. What's really interesting is this project has been translated into Catalan, Basque, it's being used in Northern Ireland. That is a educational conflict resolution project that has not succeeded in solving the conflict for which it was intended is being used throughout Europe to solve conflicts that frankly are probably more amenable to a solution. But this, I was actually at some of the meetings of the teachers, and I would go and sit with the Palestinian teachers for a while and then go sit with the Israeli teachers. And it was really interesting because it was so hard for each side to come up with a narrative that even that the other side would be willing to barely tolerate. Right? So for example, the Israeli teachers insisted on calling the Arab forces that were fighting against the Jews in 1947 criminal gangs. Right? That's just, you had to call them Knufiot, criminal gangs. The Palestinians said, no, they were resistance fighters. And it was the Zionists who were the criminal gangs. And then the Israelis finally said, okay, you know what? We won't call them criminal gangs if you agree not to call us criminal gangs. And the Palestinians said, no, you were gangs. And the Zionists on that one, the Israelis just, fine, have it your way. But they argued like this on point after point after point. And there was one point where the Israeli team wrote something in their text that was wrong. It was just, as they say in Hebrew, stam to'ut, a plain error. And I pointed it out to them. And they said, you know what, we don't know if you're right, but even if you are right, we can't put it in because the Israeli education ministry would never allow it. There was a point about, they argued that Egypt had never made peace overtures to Israel after 67. It's just not true. Sadat offered Israel peace in 71. Moshe Dayan told Golda Meir, the prime minister, to accept the offer, and she turned it down. That's what really happened. So this gives you a sense of how even people of goodwill, nice people, right, who really want peace and coexistence, it's like this. They get close enough to at least to be able to agree to be in the same book on alternate pages, right? And I think in a way, maybe that's the best we can hope for right now, because this is not a stage of conflict resolution. This is a stage of conflict management. We haven't gotten to conflict resolution yet. This is not the ETA laying down its arms, except for the occasional mistake. This is not Sinn Féin separating itself or divorcing itself from the IRA. This is different. Yes? Right, precisely because facts on the ground are so different. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's over. That's the difference. Saigon fell. That's right, and this is where I reach the limits, and this is where, like my friend Eyal Nave, who's the head of the Israeli academic team for the project, the Two Narrative Project, there's a big difference between the history professor who sits in his office and does original research and the professor who makes the choice to become an educational activist. And that's, again, that's a choice I have not made as of yet, but I think I'm beginning to, because as a scholar, you can only go so far. You write books. People read the books. It's very nice. And it's very important to maintain that kind of, if the activism is just absolutely suffuses everything you do as a scholar, I think it taints your scholarship. Okay, but I don't see a problem with someone who is a scholar and who says, okay, but look, you know, in my spare time, I'm also going to be an activist, because you're right. Now, people much stronger, smarter, more brilliant than I have attempted to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, and believe me, if I had the answer of what could bring about a Palestinian state, so that as an incidental benefit, I could sit with my Palestinian colleagues and come up with a common narrative, that would be very nice. I can't do it. If I could, I wouldn't be teaching at the University of Toronto. I'd be in Washington doing something, you know, whatever people in Washington do. I've been struck over the years at the blindness, though, of those best and the brightest. You know, I've seen it, the ones who got us into Iraq and now the ones. I just remember years ago a meeting with some of these people who were so-called experts on Palestinian affairs in Washington Beltway types. And, you know, hell of a lot of good they did. You're absolutely right, though, that until Palestinians feel empowered, until they have a future, until they have a destiny, until they have a state, well, you know, their main leader did pass away, and people were saying after he's gone, then things will be better because he had the pragmatist generation of Mahmoud Abbas or Fayyad, the interior ministry. And there is this whole world of pragmatic Palestinian politicians and academics. And, you know, I don't know, have you had Sari Nusseibeh here, the president of Al-Quds University, former minister of Jerusalem Affairs in the PA cabinet, or Hanan Ashrawi, who's maybe a little bit more radical, but still more. I mean, there's all kinds of really interesting, capable people in Palestinian politics, but they haven't prevailed for all kinds of reasons, and we know what's happened. It's fallen into, you know, complete anarchy. And again, talk about agency. I mean, there's lots of blame to be cast on many different sides for it. So, you know, you could argue that what I'm doing here is simply superstructure, and that what matters is the base, and the base is political. For that, you have to go to a different talk. Other questions? Yes. Oh, yeah, well, colleague in the most extended sense of the word. Well, this is actually a good example, kind of a good negative example, again, for the students here, that if you read, I don't know, Ilan Pape, who's got a PhD from Oxford, and he's an intelligent man, he's worth reading, he knows the Arabic sources, he's politically very biased, but it's worth reading his stuff. Michael Newman, I don't even know what his original specialty is, but he doesn't know Arabic. Okay, he doesn't know Arabic, he doesn't know Hebrew. He doesn't do any source research. He has very strong political views, and he expresses them on the web or whatever, and he says outrageous things in the classroom. And, you know, it just makes my heart sink, because this is not education. Alan Dershowitz, I've been told by his students, is a very good law professor. He is not, you know, he does. Now, does this mean I'm saying that only people who belong to the guild, who have PhDs in history and can read the esoteric sources or whatever, should be able to make statements? Of course not. Look at journalists. There are a lot of journalists who write very intelligent, thoughtful stuff about the Arab-Israeli conflict and every other thing in the world without steeping themselves in the languages and the cultures. Although, having said that, the best of all the journalists in the Middle East was Tom Friedman, who's now past his prime. But here was a man who did know Hebrew and Arabic well. So maybe there is a connection. So my answer is I'm dismayed by it, because Michael Newman doesn't contribute to the discussion in a helpful way, and neither does Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz is very flashy and very intelligent. I've read his work. He simply takes bad secondary literature that's written from a strongly political point of view and then uses it as an adversarial brief, because that's what Dershowitz is. He's an attorney. I'm married to an attorney. I know what it's like. Okay, I know what it's like. Her job is to defend her client. Doesn't matter if her client committed the crime or not, you know? So, but I, look, this is the world, though. And all of you, regardless of your age or your position in life, you're going to be surrounded by polemicists or scholars who are polemical but who are so intelligent and interesting that they're worth reading anyway, like Noam Chomsky or Edward Said, or, you know, scholars who I'd say are a little bit less politically polemical but still have a very strong point of view, like the Rashid Khalidis of the world and so on. You're going to have to make these decisions on everything you read. And it's especially hard because you don't have the base. So the answer to this is for all of you, of course, to take a year-long course on the history of Israel and the Arab-Israeli conflict. Sof pasuk, or? Yeah? No? Well, I can also hang out a little while if people want to, you know, people want to chat or whatever. Okay.
So thank you so much for the talk.
Thank you very much.